This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Ring of Fire Studios in Pensacola, Florida, thanks to the kind accommodations by Mike Papantonio and Scott Milliken.
You will bankrupt us with your foolish wars, and you pay nothing in return. And into the bargain, you endanger our lives and liberties by your mistakes. Have you not one word to say for yourself?
Yes.
Silence!
If you're familiar with ancient Greek comedy, you probably remember Lysistrata, the play by Aristophanes, in which the women of Greece attempt to end a war by withholding from their war-obsessed men the one thing only they can offer. Surely you remember sex. In 411 BC, traditional gender roles didn't leave women with many other avenues of political influence. Well, obviously, that's no longer the case. In government, in politics, and in militaries around the world today, women as well as men are in positions of leadership. So what is the 21st century premise of the relatively new organization, Women for Women, Knitting for Peace? We'll find out on this week's show. You stay tuned. You need to know about it. We'll be joined by the founder of that organization, Susan McKee.
The Seven Mountains, and our need to basically retake those hills. Mm-hmm. What are the Seven Mountains?
Well, they're business, government, arts and entertainment, media, education, the family, and the church.
And Father, you say in your word, who ascends to my holy hill? He who has clean hands and a pure heart.
As an elected leader, I'm all too aware of government's limitations when it comes to fixing things that are spiritual in nature.
Well, it should be obvious, most of this country's mainstream media just doesn't get it. They tiptoe around issues of church-state separation, ready to call anyone who tries to bring attention to the concerted far-right effort to grow theocratic influence in our nation paranoid, alarmist, and sometimes even anti-Christian. The thing is, one doesn't need to decode some secret scrolls to observe the influence of authoritarian, dominionist theory as it grows in our country. The purveyors of this school of thought are talking about it every day on well-funded, widely broadcast television and radio programs, and they're writing about it on the World Wide Web. Resources for interpreting what we hear through these channels and the instances when a voice from this movement is heard but usually misunderstood in mainstream political dialogue are few and far between. We try to be such a resource here at State of Belief Radio. Another is a valuable website, talktoaction.org, and we're going to be talking to co-founder Frederick Clarkson, an old friend of this show, back this week on State of Belief Radio. But first, we first met our next guest last year, just about this time, as a prominent young leader in the interfaith movement and an atheist. He was participating in the Interfaith Leadership Institutes in Washington, D.C. as a mentor. He hasn't slowed down since then. Chris Stedman is the Interfaith and Community Service Fellow for the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard University. The Emeritus Managing Director of State of Formation at the Journal of Interreligious Dialogue, and the founder of the first blog dedicated to exploring atheist interfaith engagement called Nonprofit Status. Now, that prophet is P-R-O-P-H-E-T. Chris, I'm really happy to have you back on this show, and for anyone who doesn't yet get the level of sophistication you bring to the discussion, I've got just one word, and it's the name of your upcoming book, Faithiest. Man, I wish I'd thought of that. Chris Stedman, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so great to be back.
You really do have a way with words. As the world watches the growing Occupy America movement, your latest piece on Huffington Post is headlined Occupy Interfaith: Why Millennials, Including the Irreligious, Need to Care About Religion. Okay, why?
Well, the reason I wrote that piece is because, you know, I'm 24 years old. The majority of my friends are in their early to mid-20s. And one of the things that I have noticed in conversations with my friends about religion is that there seems to be a really significant percentage of people my age who don't consider themselves religious, nor do they consider themselves explicitly atheist. But they're sort of somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. They, you know, you could call them irreligious in the sense that they think that, you know, for a number of different reasons, they believe that religion is not hugely important to their lives. You know, they perhaps haven't put too much thought into how they personally identify religiously, and they seem to believe that it's not something that's particularly relevant to their day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. And so as I watched this Occupy movement grow, and as I participated in it some, I was hugely inspired by what I saw as this rejection of apathy by a lot of people my age, people who decided, you know, it's imperative that we become involved in the political and democratic process, and it's imperative that we care about these issues that affect us. Mm-hmm. And I watched that passion, and it got me thinking about the ways in which, you know, I really believe that more people in my generation need to become involved in these conversations about religion, religious identity, and the ways in which they impact all of our lives. Mm-hmm. And I see the two, especially in the involvement that I've had with the protest chaplains movement, I see the two as really intertwined, that in order to reject apathy about politics, we must also reject apathy about religious identity. I very strongly feel that the assumption that religion has no application to one's life is wrong. I think that it doesn't account for the reality that the world that we live in is in many ways largely defined by people's religious beliefs. We live in a world where, you know, a large number of people do care and do think about religion a lot. And even here in the United States, even among millennials, there was a Pew study that came out in 2010 that found that actually the intensity of religious millennials' beliefs are as strong today as they were among previous generations, and that levels of certainty in belief have actually increased from previous generations, and that millennials are more inclined than previous generations to believe that their own beliefs are essentially the, you know, one true mm-hmm. path.
Yeah.
So this idea that religion is going to decline with modernization is actually, it's a theory that's been roundly debunked.
Yeah. What's been your involvement in the Occupy movement, and I'm particularly interested in you talking about where your aims in humanist interfaith work, where do those aims intersect with the Occupy movement?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have to tell you the truth. I have a lot of commitments, and so I haven't been able to be as involved on the ground with the Occupy movement as I might like to be. Uh-huh. I have spent a fair amount of time at Occupy Boston. I was there the night that over 140 people were arrested. You know, I was there with the protest chaplains to make sure that people weren't hurt and that their civil liberties weren't violated. And I've spent a considerable amount of time there, but not nearly as much as I might like to. So you know, I think that the stories of the Occupy movement are best conveyed by those who have been there day in and day out. But at the same time, you know, I do believe that everyone who falls into this 99% has a stake in this movement. You know, we're the most class divided of all the world, so-called developed nations. And what I see coming out of the Occupy movement is a feeling that people are, you know, they're frustrated and tired of a system that seems to largely serve those in positions of power while marginalizing the concerns of the vast majority of people in this country and around the world. But more specifically, I see an intersection between the work that I do as an atheist advocating for religious and non-religious dialogue and action rooted in shared values, because I see that and love that the Occupy movement is about the democratic ideal of ensuring that a multiplicity of voices are heard and that a multiplicity of concerns are expressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this idea that everyone has a voice, everyone has a story, everyone has value. I mean, that's the bedrock of interfaith dialogue right there. And so to me, they seem to be natural parallels.
Yeah.
And similarly, you know, having spent some time at Occupy Boston, I'm so inspired by the model of the Occupy movement being rooted in notions of both interdependence and personal responsibility simultaneously. You know, it's a movement that's guided by a recognition that we all benefit when people band together and contribute based on their unique skills and passions and lift up others.
We've got to take a short break, but there's more to come. Please stay tuned. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is Chris Stedman, founder of the website Nonprofit Status and a frequent contributor to the Huffington Post, the Washington Post's On Faith, and other publications. Chris, how did you get here? Talk about your journey.
I grew up non-religious, actually really irreligious. We just didn't really talk about religion as a family. And then when I was 11 years old, I had a born-again experience, and I became a born-again Christian. Shortly thereafter, I realized that I was gay, and I really struggled with those things for a long time until eventually in college I decided that I was an atheist. Largely, I just felt as if my conversion in the first place was sort of impure and that I was converting not because of the theological claims but because of the community. But given the negative experiences that I had, I really struggled with this idea of religion for a number of years. I essentially decided, though I was studying religion in college, that I didn't want to talk about religion in my personal life, in my personal relationships, or in the work that I was doing. I strictly studied it academically.
Mm-hmm.
But what I eventually realized is that inhibited me from having meaningful conversations with people who had different worldviews and different metaphysical beliefs than I did.
Mm-hmm.
And that resentment was holding me back from these meaningful engagements and from collaborating around the shared values that we held.
Where do you feel more at home, at Occupy Boston or at Harvard?
My background is, I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in a, you know, low-income family. I went to a small private liberal arts college. I worked full-time while I was in college. I worked full-time while I was doing my master's degree, again, at a small institution. So I'll tell you, you know, when I came to Harvard about a year ago, it was culture shock, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, I feel at home in both worlds.
Good.
The Occupy movement feels a lot more like the environment that I grew up in. I was very involved in a lot of civil disobedience movements when I was younger. Protesting the Iraq War and so on. But there's, you know, Harvard is a bastion of ideas and enthusiasm, and people here genuinely do care about improving the world and using their skills to make the world a better place for people. And so, you know, I actually see the two as somewhat similar in that respect, in the sense that Occupy Boston is a container for ideas to revolutionize the ways in which we engage with one another and the ways in which we care for one another. And I see that here at Harvard, especially here in the humanist community and in the various chaplaincies that I work with here at Harvard.
You are at home in bringing very different worlds together. And that's a great gift.
Well, thank you. It's been a very great experience being at Harvard for the last year. Even though when I first, you know, strolled into a meeting with some of the other chaplains that are here, you know, I was wearing a short sleeve shirt. All of my tattoos were exposed. And I, you know, it was sort of a moment of culture shock. We looked at each other like, can we trust each other? Can we work with one another? And as soon as we started talking, that's, you know, those barriers came down. And that's why I do this work.
I didn't know you had tattoos. We might not have had you on this show. Listen, Chris, what do you see as holding the biggest promise for the interfaith movement in this country, and what do you see as the biggest threat?
Well, honestly, I think, you know, the interfaith movement for some time, you know, it has a lot of roots in inter-Abrahamic work. Mm-hmm. And that work is so important, and I would never denigrate that work. But I see the tipping point of this movement, and I think we're approaching it now, but I see the tipping point as bringing in the communities that have been so difficult to bring in historically, the non-religious, the irreligious, you know, the more perhaps folks who identify as evangelical Christian. Mm-hmm. Once this movement grows to the size where it can be flexible enough to accommodate such a diverse coalition of perspectives, that's when the movement begins to have real impact on a broader level than it has in the past. Mm-hmm. And again, I say that not to denigrate all of the amazing, incredible work that's been done in this movement in the past. I see the challenge as being that very same thing. The challenge lies in making this a movement that is a safe space for everyone. And as it expands, it's important to ensure that it doesn't become so watered down and meaningless, that it doesn't hold meaning for folks who have been involved in it for a long time.
What's the best way to keep up on your work? How can people follow what you're doing?
I would say, you know, I try to update regularly at nonprofitstatus.com. Okay. I also have some other panelists who contribute regularly there. I tweet a lot. I'm also on Facebook. Those are all great ways to follow what I'm doing.
Talk to us just for a second about recent events in which you've been involved. What is on the horizon for you?
Well, on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, we organized a meal packing event here where we packaged over 10,000 meals for food insecure children in Massachusetts. We're going to replicate that event in November, but do it on a larger scale, doubling our efforts to over 20,000 meals. If you're interested in helping to support that event, you can find more information on harvardhumanist.org. It's an interfaith event. Similarly, we're hosting an interfaith event at Park 51 next month in New York City on November 15th. You can find information on that event also on harvardhumanist.org.
Great. Chris Stedman is the Interfaith and Community Service Fellow for the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard University. He's the founder of the first blog dedicated to exploring atheist interfaith engagement, Nonprofit Status. His memoir is due out next year from Beacon Press. It's called Faithiest, How One Atheist Learned to Overcome the Religious-Secular Divide and Why Atheists and the Religious Must Work Together. I know that's going to be fascinating reading. It's always fascinating talking with you, Chris, and I thank you for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's completely my pleasure, and please keep up the great work that you're doing.
Still to come on this week's show, Knitting for Peace. And up next, our old friend Frederick Clarkson of faithtoaction.org. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Don't go away. We'll be right back. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. It's often challenging to sift through news stories regarding the encroaching influence of religion on our politics and government. That's why it is so important to have some resources available for rational explanation and analysis of some of these developments. One such resource is the website TalkToAction.org. Talk to Action, and the two is the numeral two. And I'm happy to welcome the co-founder of that site, an old friend of this show, Frederick Clarkson, back to State of Belief Radio. Fred was on with us a few years back talking about his book, Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America. He's also the author of the book, Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Fred Clarkson, it hasn't gone away, and thankfully you haven't gone away. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks, and you haven't gone away either, thankfully.
That's right. Thank you for saying that. The slogan for TalkToAction.org is Reclaiming Citizenship, History, and Faith. I like that very much. Before we talk about your latest post, which exposes the ongoing inability of mainstream religion writers to take the Dominionism movement seriously, give us a little background on your website and its mission.
We got started because there was really no one place to do this kind of writing and publish short blog posts, a research paper, a thoughtful political analysis. And where anybody can come to find that and participate in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We also figured out that organizations and others have their own agendas, their own missions, and those are good to have, but not all the conversation fits neatly within such a mission.
Right.
So we need to have a place that could be a little more eclectic, mm-hmm. where there could be some reasonable debate, and at the same time, within certain reasonable constraints.
Fred, a few months ago on this show, we looked at the dismissive tone that some mainstream religion journalists continue to take towards concerns about the encroaching influence of Dominionism in our politics. In your recent article, you used the phrase, the literature of poo-poo-ery about Dominionism and the new apostolic reformation. I love that. What is the latest instance of poo-poo-ery?
Well, the latest one was a very lengthy religion feature from the Associated Press, which is certainly the agenda-setting media outlet in the nation, if not in the world. And it was supposed to sort things out on the issues that came out of the Rick Perry's prayer rally and the role of a mysterious outfit called the New Apostolic Reformation, mm-hmm. which has these theocratic elements in it, what we generally refer to as Dominionism. Well, there's been quite a media hoo-ha about the whole thing, and so a group of religion scholars were consulted, and the upshot was nobody knew what it meant, and nobody could tell if it was a problem or not.
The ultra-conservative religious right has so many media outlets of its own that one really only needs to listen to their radio programs or watch their TV networks or read their websites to understand this. But I mean, millions of Americans are taking this stuff in daily. why can't the rest of us understand that this isn't happening in a vacuum?
I think we get complacent and comfortable, and there's a certain sense of it can't happen here. The idea of there being active people who take their theocratic beliefs seriously and act on them politically is an alien idea to most of us, particularly if you don't actively use the word theocracy. I mean, people are sophisticated in their public relations sensibilities these days, and they don't use words that are going to be off-putting. That doesn't mean that the meaning doesn't remain the same.
Say to our listeners, just in case anyone is still scratching their head saying, what is dominionism, tell it just like it is.
Dominionism generally means that an idea of founding, refounding the United States as a Christian nation governed under biblical principles, biblical law. It means taking the oath, the ideas of the Ten Commandments and the laws from Old Testament Israel and making them applicable in the United States as we are today, and that Christians of the correct sort would be the governing body, and people who were not of the correct sort would be either second-class citizens or criminalized and possibly subject to the death penalty.
Are we likely to hear expressions of dominionism either blatantly or subtly expressed in this time's presidential campaign?
Perhaps not by the candidates themselves, because their handlers would be too wise, but certainly in the people around them and in the movements that are organized to carry them forward.
Mm-hmm.
The Perry rally was had 20,000 people, and it was organized primarily by active, vocal dominionists. There's never been in the entire history of American presidential politics a prayer rally as the launch of a presidential campaign, let alone one of that scale.
Right. I think when I learned about dominionism, I heard you talk about dominionism along with others. My sense was that any reasonable American that hears these kinds of descriptions of these people's work will turn that off so quickly and be afraid of what that would do to our democracy. But as I said in the beginning of this conversation, they're still at it and you're still at it. I'm still at it, as you pointed out. Why has it not gone away?
What is, I think that there are people who are seriously committed to their ideas and they have some resources. And they're effective organizers. We're not talking about crazy people.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about very skilled, educated, capable people who don't share the values of the rest of us about religious freedom and separation of church and state and religious pluralism. These are antithetical, heretical ideas that need to be stamped out. And that's a powerful, powerful brew. On the other hand, most of us have done a poor job of understanding what's going on, that there are these dynamic anti-democratic elements in our society, and we need to better understand them, better articulate our critiques, and especially come up with better responses so that we can preserve and defend the values that we hold dear.
My friends, the website is talktoaction.org. That's the word talk, the numeral two, and the word action.org. I've been speaking with co-founder Frederick Clarkson, TalkToAction.org, whose latest book is Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America. It's a good time to read that book. He's also the author of the book Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Fred, it's always enlightening to spend time with you, and I thank you for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for having me, Welton.
We've got to take a quick break, but please, please stay tuned. Susan McKee, founder of Women for Women, Knitting for Peace, will be with us. I think you will love this interview and her project. That's coming up next on State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. One of the risks of closely following the news is the danger of becoming depressed and overwhelmed. Bad news is everywhere, and the suffering and inequities are so great that it's a normal defense mechanism to simply tune it out, going on about the more mundane matters of daily life. So then, I'm always fascinated by people that somehow don't let themselves become paralyzed, but rather find some form of action they can take, something that's meaningful for them and helpful to other people. Often the action is unexpected, unusual, and yet the positive human impact can be immeasurable. This past summer, when I was at Chautauqua Institute, my wife Judy was with me, and Judy met a woman named Susan McKee. And Susan McKee is a profile, an incarnation of the kind of person that I just described. Her endeavor is women for women. Women, and she uses the numerical four, women. Women for women, knitting for peace. And on the line right now, fortunately, is this group's founder, Susan McKee. Judy, my wife, said, you need to have her on State of Belief Radio. I do most of what my wife tells me to do, not all of it, but following through on this one has been great. Susan, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's a privilege to be with you.
Well, let's start with what Knitting for Peace is. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Knitting for Peace is a vision and a conviction and a community. It's women across the United States and Canada who believe that small actions can transform our world. So we engage in small physical acts, nonviolent acts, that we combine with our prayer and our intention for a world that will be a better world. Our outward and visible signs are knit and crocheted and woven items. When we first began, we began just making peace shawls for other women, and since then, we have felt the spirit's movement and have begun making knit dolls for boys and girls around the world that we call Peace Pals. We do scarves for children and teens and caps for children and teens and blankets of peace for families in communities like Pine Ridge Indian Reservation.
How did this come to you? How did you think of this?
I didn't really think of it, Welton. It was one of those movements of the spirit that came from over a year's worth of discernment. We were at Chautauqua the summer of 2004 when Sister Joan Chittister was present with some women from a community in Israel, a community called Neve Shalom Wahat al-Salam, which in Hebrew and Arabic means oasis of peace. And Sister Joan Chittister's message that week was that peace will never happen in our world until women become involved in radical new ways. And the women from Neve Shalom Wahat al-Salam said, please don't forget about us. Please don't forget about us. And those two voices resonated for me in a deeply powerful way. I spent the next year, I didn't know it was going to take that long, but I tried to pay attention to the nudging and the yearning that seemed to be very, very strong inside of me in response to those women's voices, and did a lot of prayerful work with my mentors. And the following summer, when we were back at Chautauqua, interestingly, I had what I can only describe as a bit of a vision that women really could be engaged in radical new ways of peacemaking, and that it could be done in a way that really could make a difference in the world. And the things that we do are really outward signs of our effort to knit together the global beloved community.
And you've been able to do that. You've got people participating in this from all over the country and beyond. In fact, let me ask you, who's doing the knitting?
Well, everyone from children as young as 6 to women who are as old as 101. So we're cross-generational. We don't have a whole lot of cross-gender involvement, but we do have some. And we're in women knit individually in their own private lives, and they sometimes gather together in intentional groups. We have over 30 groups that we call peace pods that across the country come together to do this work as a community.
Hmm. Let's go to the other end of it now. Who receives your peace shawls and dolls and other works that you've knitted?
Women and children in what we call global areas of conflict, which might mean areas of conflict in our own neighborhoods. It might mean areas of conflict all over the world. We have all of our deliveries are personal deliveries. We don't go through anonymous groups for delivering, but we have personal connections for all of our deliveries, and we have completed deliveries in 39 countries. We're a little over 5 years old. So just keep growing. We go where the need calls us.
Do you get any feedback from those countries?
We do. We repeatedly hear from recipients of the things we deliver how powerful it is for them, that they feel a very strong sense of the prayers that went into the creation of the items that are received. We frequently hear in different kinds of language people's sense of the presence of God when they receive our things. So the sense of community being created is reflected back to us in the feedback that we get, sometimes in emails that recipients send us, but most frequently it comes through the delivery agents themselves. A lot of the people we deliver to are not literate or not able to have access to international technology. So a lot of what we hear comes back through the people who actually did the delivering.
I want you to be sure to tell our listeners how they can find out more about Knitting for Peace. I know they're going to be interested. Some will want to be involved. I know you're about to launch a new website in a few weeks, but how right now could they find out about Knitting for Peace?
If they would like direct communication with me, they can send an email to me at susan@knittingforpeace.org. Those are all lowercase letters, and the Knitting for Peace is with the number 4. The new website will be launched on November 11th, and that website will be knittingforpeace.org. In the meantime, we have a very, very old website that's up. It's 4.5 years old, so it's not much, but it's something. And that's womenforwomenknittingforpeace.org, our full name.
Well, you're spending all your time knitting instead of working on the website. I understand that. Susan, the answer has to be succinct. What has leading and participating in Knitting for Peace done to Susan?
It has deepened my sense of the mystery of creation. And it has deepened my respect for the yearning of so many people to be able to make a difference in our world and in the lives of other people.
Mm. Susan, we're going to link to both web addresses from our site, stateofbelief.com. Susan McKee is the founder of Women for Women Knitting for Peace, a loosely knit, pardon the pun, group of individuals creating prayer shawls for others whom they have never met in faraway, war-torn places. Susan, thank you so much for being with us today, and much success in your work.
Welton, thank you very much. It has been a great blessing for me to be here.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. And let me say, I love this week's show, and I hope you did too. It could be not just a source of information for you, but a source of inspiration as well. Be encouraged by this. Listen to these stories and know that on State of Belief, we don't want just your attention. We encourage your action. These three people are doing something. Find what you can do. And we'll have you on to talk about that on this show as well, and we'll give you affirmation. Visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, listen to show archives as well as extended interviews, read transcripts, sign up for our podcasts. Tell us what you like about this program and what you think we could do better. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the listener line 202-238-3291. Please tell a friend about our show and encourage others to listen to it as well. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. You can find more information on the work of the Alliance, both in Washington and in chapters across the country, at interfaithalliance.org. This work is important. You can become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.